Hello and welcome to this special episode of Daughters of Narcissistic Mother podcast. Today we have as a guest Remy Ramirez. Remy is a life coach and a host of the Patrama Party podcast, which is available on all the major podcast platforms. So welcome, Remy. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So today we are going to talk about of course, we're going to talk about narcissistic mothers, which is something that myself and Remy have in common. But we're going to talk about those narcissistic mothers that are not the absolute villains. So those that, you know, you reach out to me and you're asking me questions and you're like, I'm not really sure if she's a narcissist, because actually there are moments in which she's really lovely and in which she's showing me love and she actually even seems to have empathy. So what's the story with that? And I do have an episode on the podcast about the false empathy of a narcissistic mother, and I will include the link in the description of this episode. But in general, when we're talking about narcissism, and remember that a lot of the time we're talking about not a pure diagnosis, we're not like professionals giving diagnosis, but we are daughters looking at our mothers and picking up signs and noticing that behaviors are off. Not always things are that black and white. And that was my experience with my mother. Tons of stuff seemed really, really lovely at times, which made it a lot more complicated for me to understand what was really going on. And of course, that also feeds the guilt, because there's those good moments and then there's the bad ones and it gets very complicated. So Remy, I'd love for you to speak a little bit about your experience with that, because I know we've connected before and I know that that has been your experience.
Yeah, this was exactly why it was so hard for me to go no contact with my mom. I didn't go no contact until I was in my 40s. And there was so much pain around it because, and this is what, you know, I say about my mom. My mom is not a Cruella de Vil. She's not a cartoon villain. She is a whole person and a very complex person. And we had shared a lot of love. We had shared care. We had shared sweet moments. There were moments where I did feel taken care of by my mom. And so negotiating that, trying to understand that, while it was juxtaposed with behavior that seemed so cruel, made it extremely difficult for me to even set a boundary with my mom. And, you know, another layer of that, and I'm sure you have listeners who can relate to this. My mom, if I had to give an armchair diagnosis, I would say covert narcissist, but right, like, this is my opinion. She's never been diagnosed with this. But as we know, covert narcissism operates in a really different way than grandiose narcissism. And my mom was a single mom. She came from a very abusive childhood. And she left my dad because he was physically abusive. He was cheating on her. He was, you know, doing drugs, right? Like, so my mom had this elaborate victim story. She was terrorized as a child. She was done wrong by my dad in this way. And then she took the reins and raised us all by herself. And when you look at all of that on paper, that is truly heroic, right? Like, that is, wow, like, what an amazing person. And that is true. Like, that really is true. That was hard what she went through. And next to that was the way that she weaponized the guilt around that towards her children. So she would say things to us like, I could have been really successful if it hadn't been for you girls. I gave up everything for you. She told us when I was little, your father doesn't love us. Right. Things that were just like, with the implication of like, I love you, but your father doesn't love you. Right. So like, all of this guilt being handed to us. There's also the aspect of parentification and spousification. When I was very young, my mom was telling me about the abuse she endured, the childhood abuse. So I mean, I'm talking like 5 years old. So very early on, my brain was wired to see my mom as the victim and the hero, which again, like that is how narcissists often want to be seen, as the victim and the hero. And that is why, when the time came for me to look really honestly at her cruelty toward me, it was nearly impossible for me to do at the outset because I was so wired to see her as blameless. I was so wired to see her as purely the victim. But things started happening. Whoops. Things started happening that I couldn't shake off. I couldn't excuse. And one of those happened when I was 18 years old. My high school sweetheart, who I was, yes, we had broken up and gotten back together, but I really trusted him. I really loved him. I really thought that we had each other's backs. And then I found out that he had cheated on me. And it was egregious. All my friends knew. No one told about me. I was devastated. One time, my mom found me sobbing in a closet. I mean, like, really not doing well around this situation. And I went off to college. I got an eating disorder. I mean, I essentially stopped eating. Because in my mind, my thought was, oh, if I had been prettier, this never would have happened, which again, that's like another common symptom of being raised by narcissists. I'm the problem. I must have done something to deserve this. I'm wrong. So I came back home for Christmas, and it was just me and my mom on Christmas Day. I was so happy. We had done presents, we were making food, we had Christmas music on. I was doing great. There's a knock on the door. I run over to get it, thinking it's one of my girlfriends. And it's my ex-boyfriend. And he's standing there with a gift in his hand. And of course, my first thought is, oh, he's come, to grovel. He's come to ask for forgiveness. But the first thing he says is your mom home? And then I hear my mom in the background go, oh, is that, and, yeah, oh, is that him? Oh, comes running over. Oh, is this for me? Oh, I have something for you too. Come in, come in. Merry Christmas. Right. My mom was fully aware of what had happened. Brings this guy in. They sit down. Do you want a glass of wine? They start having Christmas. And I'm just standing there. My mom doesn't look at me one single time. She doesn't ask me, hey, are you okay? Nothing. Of course, obviously, she doesn't care if I'm okay because she already invited this person who she knows devastated me. I go to my room, sob for a few hours. I hear him leave. I'm like, okay, I'm going to my friend's house. I come downstairs. I work up all my nerve because, again, narcissists deflect. They attack you if you hold them accountable. They're not interested in your feelings, right? So that was already my experience with my mom. So I came downstairs and I said, Mom, it really hurt my feelings that you had him over here knowing what he did to me. And my mom looked up at me from her crossword puzzle and she said, wow, thanks a lot for ruining Christmas, Remy. That was a real turning point for me. The betrayal was so deep. It was so deep. And I didn't have anyone in my world who could validate that it was absolutely not okay. I didn't have anyone who could reflect back to me, your mom is not always the hero. Your mom has betrayed you. No one was really saying that. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, I guess that sucks, but like, I'm sure she has her reasons, that kind of thing. And so since then, right, like that, I was very young, I was 18. There have been many, of course, there were many things leading up to that. There were many things after that. It took a long time for me to get from that point to the point of no contact. And what I'll say is the real intervention that I needed was therapy. I needed a therapist to say to me, look, hey, she's not here. I can't diagnose her. But if I were going to give a diagnosis, this to me looks like narcissism. And one thing that she told me that it took me years to accept was narcissists can't love. I really couldn't hear that at the time. I heard it and I was shocked by it, but I was still willing to try. I was still willing to try to make it work because you only get one mom, you know? And like I said, there were so many things about my mom. There were so many times when my mom had made me feel loved in different ways. So it really took something so far outside of the realm of even a little bit okay for me to finally say, I matter and my emotional safety matters more than any story of what you did for us, or any story I might have about, well, this could be an example of love. And so what happened eventually was I got into therapy. I started setting boundaries with my mom. That didn't go over well, as a, you know,
They
I'm sure
never do.
you, did not go over well at all. And eventually, what happened was I found out from a mutual friend, someone I trusted very much, that my mom had told her that I had essentially been asking for it when I was raped when I was 14. And all of this came to a head because when I was raped when I was 14, I brought it to my mom and I said to her, you know, this is what happened. I was very shaken up. This was a boy that I had had a big crush on who lived in our apartment building, and I needed support. I needed mothering. And what my mom said to me in that moment was, I can't believe that he did that to me, as in to her. And I said, what do you mean he did it to me? And she said, no, but he and I are friends. It was all about her. And then the conversation was over. She never brought it up again. And then 6 months later, as I am plummeting. My mental health is taking a huge nosedive. I went into such a serious depression. And I wrote a poem about the situation and I showed it to my mom. This is 6 months after the event. And my mom read it in front of me and then she handed it back to me and she said, "Aren't you over this yet?" I talked about that in an episode on my podcast. And my mom heard the episode and was so upset that that's when she went to this mutual friend and said this, said, you know, Remy enticed that boy. And then she couldn't handle what she got. That's what happened. And I'm paraphrasing because I wasn't present for that conversation. And this is essentially what was told to me. Is it possible that this person made this up? Sure, I guess. However, she also knew things about the event that only my mom knew. So clearly, this conversation took place. So, when that happened, I finally just had to get so clear and do something so painful that I didn't want to do, which was tell my mom, this is done because you have crossed a line that I cannot excuse in any way. I cannot return from. I can never trust you again. You've broken trust with me to the point of no return. And what I said to her when I sent that email was, I am doing this for the 14-year-old child inside me who had no one to protect her. You didn't protect her then, but I will protect her now. And that was really the moment where I realized fully that I was going to have to parent myself in the way that I deserve to be parented because my mom just wasn't capable of it. And this is something that I say to people who are processing having a narcissistic parent. Because I spoke with someone recently who her grandiose narcissist father was on his deathbed and was wanting more and more, wanting her. She had gone no contact, but he wanted her there. And she was really feeling a lot of guilt about not wanting to be around him. And here's what I say that has been true for me and that I hope is helpful to others. The way that I see my mom is not like a monster. I see her like a dog who has rabies. And what I mean by that is a dog that gets rabies is just a sweet, happy dog that's living its life. And then something attacks it and infects it with rabies. And that's how I see, for example, the abuse that my mom experienced. She was terribly abused. And then she got infected. And that is a sad thing. That's a horrible thing. But I don't look at a dog running around my neighborhood who has rabies and think, gosh, it's so sad that that dog got infected with rabies. I think I'll invite it into my home. No, that dog is absolutely not allowed to come in. Not because I hate the dog, but because I love myself and I value my well-being above whatever the dog's needs are. I have to take care of me first. And that was really the reality I had to come to.
Yes, because there's one thing is understanding the mechanism. It's something that I get asked quite a bit. It's like, so why is my mother a narcissist? Like, why is she this toxic? What the hell happened? And of course, well, there's theories of, there's lots of different things that are said. I personally, in my experience, I don't believe that the vast majority of people that are labeled toxic or narcissistic were born like that. It's there's trauma. Trauma in the system. When you're talking, experts like Dr. Gabor Mate will tell you that every child during the formative years, at the very beginning, toddlers actually have narcissistic traits because that's part of the natural development of a child. And then at that point, trauma happens and they get frozen in that state. It's like their development stops there. The other pathways are just not there. So I remember with my kids, you'd be like, oh, someone would tell them, like maybe grandparents, you have to share. And it's like, well, you can't share until you've owned. So you have to go through that phase where you're actually somewhat narcissistic, you're egocentric, you're totally tuned in with yourself only, and you're kind of going, this is mine. And then from there, you start gently, safely experimenting and play with pathways of empathy, pathways of love for other people, the sharing pathways, and all of that. So the childhood that our parents and our mothers in this case had didn't allow for that. And to some people, this gets this result that they develop more or less to different degrees, these patterns of narcissism. So understanding is one thing, and a lot of compassion can actually come from understanding where they come from. But this is where then you want to draw the line, and I totally get your analogy with the rabbit dog. It's like you don't want to let them into your life. Or at the very least, you gotta set very, very clear boundaries as to what's okay and what's not okay.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned the whole thing about that a narcissist can't love and how that was like a revelation for you and quite an important moment. And I totally get that. So we've spoken about these moments where that seem loving, and they are, but they we've And I know you've learned that as well. Like I've learned from my experience that ultimately it's actually not love for you. It's a twisted way to get them to get something back for themselves. It's like to ease a discomfort in themselves. And so there is this moment that I don't know if you've had that moment, but where you actually, I know in my own experience, there was a moment where I realized actually my mother really never loved me, as in she did in her own twisted way, because that was her the best of her capacity. But the way I'm loving my daughters, she never actually loved me that way. And there was like a lot of grief, of course, that I had to go through with that. So have you experienced that? Have you been through that?
And that man, that was, God, it was the hardest thing, because as children who have parents, wrapping your head around the idea that your parent can't love you, especially like for me in my relationship with my mom, it's like I had this story. My mom put food on the table by herself. She worked so hard. She put me through college. How could she do all those things if she didn't love me, right? There are moments when I look back when I think to myself, like, oh, that's what was going on. And like, for example, part of how I coped with the abuse I experienced as a child was overachieving, because it didn't get me anything with my dad. My dad literally could have cared less. I was like non-existent to my dad. But to my mom, it really worked. My mom loved when I achieved. And that was coupled with like really having no modeling in my home for what happiness looked like. And, I grew up in the 80s, so there were lots of movies about high school, and I was taking notes, right? Like, okay, be popular, join clubs, like, be class president, whatever. So, when I became captain of the dance team and I became senior class president. And I remember when I won senior class president, we were going to find out the results at school that day. And I came home and my mom heard me put my key in the door. She ran over the door, opened the door, really expectant look on her face. And I was like, oh, I got it. And we both started screaming. We jumped up and down. We were so excited, right? Well, fast forward to the end of senior year. And it's time for people to nominate prom king and prom queen. And what they did in my school was they voted, they vote, we did a big vote, and whoever made the top 10 for prom king and the top 10 for prom queen, then we did another vote. And I made the top 10. And I said to my mom, I really hope I don't get it because A, I don't really think that's me. B, I don't want to wear that crown because it doesn't match my dress. And C, when you win, it takes up your entire night on prom. You have to do all this stuff. You have to take all these pictures, right? There's a whole, you can't just enjoy your night. And my mom was like, well, I think you are prom queen material. And I was like, no, mom, I'm saying I don't want to be prom queen. And she was like, no, I think you should. I think, like, she was very, she wasn't just like, oh, really? Well, then, yeah, I hope you don't get it. Yeah, you should enjoy your night. Oh, yeah. If you don't think it's you, right? It wasn't about me. And it was like at the time, there's a way to see it, right? Like, oh, she's saying that she thinks I'm great and that I should be prom queen. But that wasn't what she was saying. She wanted me to be her ideal daughter. She wanted to sort of live out her high school fantasy that she didn't get to have through me. And she even had said that to me one time. She said, you're the she said, you're having the school experience I always wanted to have. And that was really wild because like I had been raped and I like it, but there were blinders. It was like this was it was just about me achieving and sort of rising through the ranks of high school, whatever that looks like. So, yeah, there were a lot of moments. There was another one that happened way later when I was like, I think in my late 30s. I was living in Sedona, Arizona, and my mom was wanting to buy property in Tucson, Arizona. And she was like, I want you to move to Tucson and take over this prop live in this property for a while until we can Airbnb it out. And then I was like, no, but I love living in Sedona. I want to live in Sedona. And she was like, no, you don't. You don't even have friends there. And I was like, yes, I do. it was suddenly it was like I was being gaslit so hard. What, not, there was no like understand, there was no comprehension of this is what makes me happy, mom. I'm happy where I am. There was just this convincing of like, you're not happy there. Like, you would be happier in Tucson. This is what you should be doing. And I, at this time, had a therapist, and I took that to my therapist. You know, therapy came to me late in life. I didn't start going until I was in my late 30s. And my therapist was like, it really sounds like your mom doesn't have your best interest at heart. It really sounds like your mom has her own best interest at heart. This is a financial endeavor for her. This would financially benefit her. And so she's trying to get you on board and isn't listening to you. And that was another one of those small moments where I was like, this isn't what love looks like. But again, it really took me a long time. It took me a really, it took something just hitting me completely over the head, right? The thing about being a 14-year-old who was asking for rape. It took something that egregious for me to finally realize and look back at those moments with honesty and clarity and say, yeah, that isn't love, right? Because the way my mom was trying to spin the house in Tucson was, I'm trying to set up a living situation for you. And I was like, I love my living situation.
I
I
haven't
don't need
asked
to.
for your help.
Yeah. So, yes, there really were moments like that. And the thing is, I think my mom loved me in the way that she was able to. And it's just when a therapist says your mom can't love, she qualified that with your mom can't love the way the rest of us love. And that's what's true for me with my mom. My mom loved me in the way that she was able to. But that's not the healthy kind of love that you and I are capable of, where someone can come to us and say, hey, you really hurt my feelings, or, you know, that's not gonna, that thing you wanna do, it actually will disrupt my well-being in the end. And we can say, oh God, okay, I hear you. Sorry, you know. Let's repair. Let's figure this out. Let's come up with a new plan. That's not how a narcissist is ever going to be able to love. And that's actually what love looks like. And that's why it does take such a long time to figure out what love is, I think, for survivors who have endured this kind of abuse, this very specific kind of narcissistic abuse. It's like it really takes us a while to understand what love is and what love isn't.
Yeah, because we have this completely confusing and screwed up display of it, and our mothers are the first person that actually shows us what love and connection is meant to be. Hence, mother wounds are relational wounds. So it every time that we're working with this, and I know for myself it's been the experience, of course, but clients will come to me talking about their narcissistic mothers, and inevitably we end up, if they're in long-term relationship, we'll end up working with that because we end up relating the same way, repeating pattern, looking for the familiarity. So we end up very often with partners which who will have similar traits. They might not be full-on narcissistic, but they can have similar traits because that's what's familiar. And most of all, we are trained from a very young age to actually put up with a crazy level of abuse, right? So you've mentioned that it took big things like being told that a 14-year-old is looking for rape. I was a 13-year-old labeled by my mother, you were looking for sexual abuse from a full-on adult man. How is that even possible? I remember distinctly when she found out, it wasn't the man who was sat down. It was me who was sat down and actually being told what I did wrong and being obviously told to keep it secret. And that wasn't enough. I still thought my mother was the world. I actually 100% believed her. And for years, I kept going around saying it was my fault. So we end up then, that led me to believe that love came in this abusive, toxic way. And so I ended up with partners who were abusive. And yet I'd be like, yeah, but it must be my fault. You know, I must have done something. I must have said something. It's if I, as you mentioned, if I was prettier, if I was smarter, if I was less messed up. And then the gaslighting continues. So have you seen that in your own life, in your own experience? Have you experienced
Oh my God, 100%, honey.
that?
Oh my God. I mean, and here's one thing I'll say, and this is something you also said earlier. Boundaries are punished by narcissists. It's not just that we don't have them modeled or we don't know, blah, blah, blah. No, when you're a child, you know about boundaries innately. You like, you know, children throw a tantrum. They, you know, they're like, no, I don't like this, right? Narcissistic parents will put the fear of God in you when you put up a boundary around something. My mom would grit her teeth and say, "Don't you dare talk to me like that," right? And that was just if I was like rolling my eyes about something or like had a, you know, a little sass in my voice. I was terrified of her. And what that does is it shows us that self-respect is dangerous. Having self-respect for ourselves is dangerous. And then we go into adulthood and we are literally afraid to place a boundary and have self-respect because it's that sort of like CPTSD emotional flashback. Suddenly, you know, I'm 9 years old again and my mom is gritting her teeth at me like a vicious dog and I'm terrified. And so, you know, what I always say is when you don't know how to set boundaries. When you are so steeped in people pleasing, you create a safe place for toxic people to land in your life. You open up your world for toxic people to thrive because you don't call them on their shit. You don't call them out. You don't say, this isn't going to work for me. Narcissists love that, right? Or people on the narcissistic scale. I had a best friend for years who, here's an example with her. I came to visit her and stay with her for like 2 weeks. She asked me to come stay. It was her birthday coming up. I was like, okay. I came and stayed with her. It was a place that I had lived before, so I had other friends there and other things going on. And she had gone through a horrible breakup. And during that time, I had really nurtured her. I had made her recovery sort of a focus. Not that I was like not doing the things I needed to get done, not in like a codependent way, but it was like, okay, you're my best friend. You are hurting so badly. Let me like Let's, what do you want to do? What movie do you want to watch? Can I make you dinner? Right? Let me really take care of you. And that had happened like a couple months before when I had been in town. I came back for this 2 week period and I was going through a really bad depression, which I was scared to share with anyone because, again, growing up with narcissists, they're not loving when you tell them you're suffering, right? So they actually tell you that you're a burden on them. So I was like not telling anyone that I was going through a hard time. And one night she and I were hanging out at her house and I said, "Oh, do you want to cuddle and watch a movie?" And she said, "Actually, I don't like physical affection with friends. I only like it with men," right? She's a straight woman. And I was like, oh. And in my mind, I was like, that's weird because you really liked me doing it when you were struggling. But okay, like I hear the boundary. I'm not gonna, you know, great. I'm gonna respect that. Okay. But I also knew physical affection is really helpful for me when I'm struggling with my mental health. So the next day, I texted another friend of mine and I was like, hey, do you want to cuddle and watch a movie tonight? Because I knew she was very, very touchy-feely, very affectionate. And she was like, yes, come over. So I went over, we cuddled and had a great night. Came back to my other friend's house where I was staying. And she expressed that she was upset that I had gone to this other friend's house that night. And I was like, look, I wasn't wanting to tell you this, but I am really struggling and I have had suicidal ideation for the first time in a really long time. I'm not doing well and I know that physical affection helps me and you said you didn't like that. And so I went over to her house 'cause it's something that she likes and it's I'm just trying to feel okay. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, everyone tells me I'm a really good friend. I had just said to this woman that I was having suicidal ideation. And she took what I said, made it about her, made it seem like I was attacking the kind of friend that she was. And that was the end of the conversation. It was just like my mom. And what did I do in that moment? Instead of being like, girl, what? I said, no, you are a really good friend. That's not what I'm saying. I started comforting her. I had just said that I was having suicidal ideation, and now I'm comforting her. I stayed in that friendship for another like 3 years. That there could not have been a bigger red flag than that moment. But again, I was so accustomed to people treating me like my feelings didn't matter, like I was a burden, like I was attacking them if I was talking about my feelings, right? Like that gaslighting and that Darvo, right? I'm not sure if you talk to your listeners about Darvo, but it's a process, it's an acronym, and it's like deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. So you deny this person's truth, you attack them for having it, and then you reverse. Now, I'm not the offender, I'm the victim and you're the offender, right? That's something that narcissists and narcissistic folks do quite a bit. So I got Darvo'd in that moment, which I was totally used to. Like that was normal for me. So again, yeah, I didn't leave that relationship for many years and it took all of these experiences. I left that friendship. And then months later, I went no contact with my dad. And then months later, I went no contact with my sister. And then months later, I went no contact with my mom. So in the course of like 18 months, all the people that were closest to me in my life, I went no contact with because I started getting really serious about knowing that I mattered and knowing that my feelings mattered and knowing that I deserved people who cared about my feelings. Like I say it like it sounds like some revelation, but it's so basic. It's just like I deserve people who care when I'm hurt. It's really so simple, but for so many of us, yeah, we attract those people into our lives who make us feel like I don't want to say we attract it. We accept those people and we allow them to stay because we're so used to that kind of relationship dynamic.
Definitely. And yeah, that is that kind of flipping the pancake. That's how I call it. But they're professional at that. They're 100% professional at that. And because we've been conditioned to believe that we're faulty for some reason, because I mean, if our mother hasn't loved us unconditionally, who else is going to do that? So clearly we are inherently faulty. There is something there that isn't working. And so we believe that. And yes, we bypass about a million red flags before we get to the point. And I totally get how once you start recognizing the pattern, actually, there is a moment where a lot of people start looking very much like that around you, and you start realizing, there's a pattern here. They are all behaving the same. And at which what can happen too, and I'm really glad that you actually got to the point where you were recognizing it and just chopped them all off. But what can happen very often is that we feel even more like, because we're the common denominator, that is yet again our fault. And it's not. It's just that conditioning doesn't attract those people like some creepy law of attraction type thing, but they love that and they feed on that. So they will gravitate around you because ultimately they're allowed to. If you have no
Right.
boundaries, they're allowed to behave that way. If you set your boundaries, they're going to get angry and then they're going to move on to someone else. But of
And then
course, we
your
don't.
all the abandonment stuff comes up in you, right? Because
Of course.
when love is conditional as a child, you felt abandoned all the time. You know, like, oh, like my mom would, if I would start crying as a child, my mom would say, go to your room if you're going to cry. And it wasn't until I was an adult and understanding more about attachment styles and abuse, really, that I was like, oh, this is why, for example, with my friend, where I was trying to hide that I was struggling. I was trying my very best not to tell anyone that I was having a hard time. Those are the people you should be going to when you're having a hard time. But what I had learned was I will be abandoned if I tell people honestly how what I'm experiencing, what's coming up for me, that I'm struggling. And actually in that friendship, okay, so actually let me extend the next 24 hours. I had that conversation with her. I assured her that she was a really good friend. We went to bed. The next day, of course, I was a wreck because I had just opened up to someone who I thought really cared about me and did not get the response that I was hoping to get. My mental health was not on the up, let's just say. And I just spent the whole day trying to take care of myself, trying desperately to take care of myself. She did not text me. She did not text me one single time the next day. If my friend told me they were having suicidal ideation, I would be on watch with that person. I would be like, hey, what's your plan for today? Hey, do you wanna, I'm getting off work at this time. Would you wanna get together? I'd love to just sit with you and hear what's going on, right? No, did not text me one single time the entire day. And when I got back to my house, she had locked her door and gone to bed. Later, she said she just forgot. So I'm stranded outside. So again, this is what I was used to. This is what looked normal to me. And it is such a heartbreak. And one thing I'll say, people would say things to me, especially with the men in my life, right? Like, you just like you don't have any self-respect, right? It was this criticism of me. Like, well, you just need to have more self-respect, Remy, honestly, right? Again, self-respect is literally punished. And when you're a child and you are terrified of your parent every time you try in some small way to assert some ounce of self-respect, some like small boundary, you're not going to walk into adulthood and be like, I have so much self-respect. You literally have learned that it is dangerous to have self-respect. So I just encourage people who are coming out of this pattern to have compassion for themselves in those beginning phases of transitioning into boundaries, transitioning out of people pleasing. You are not going to have self-respect at the outset. You're just not, because it has been sort of emotionally beaten out of you, maybe physically, but certainly emotionally abused out of you. So give yourself some grace during that time frame. I stayed in that friendship for 3 more years, you know. I stayed hooked on guys who treated me like shit. Yeah, it takes time to get into the space of self-respect after you learned that it was literally dangerous to have it.
Absolutely. It's literally pathways in the nervous system that are absolutely not activated. They're not damaged, they're not broken. So there it's never too late to actually work on this and start, but it's not something that's going to happen overnight. There's stuff that needs to be unpacked. And then from there, we start sampling and experimenting. It's like what you would have done as a child. You would have experimented with, say, self-expression, with anger, with tantrum, with pushing with your little hands your mom away if she was mothering you too much. Or I know I've had experiences personally myself of like being physically abused and not and being punished for those boundaries. So that experience, I remember my mother force feeding me. I was a very slow eater. literally force feeding me pasta, you know, holding my hand and pushing it down my throat to the point that I got sick, and then get angry and beating me because I puked. So, like, those were the moments where, as a child, you say no, you set a boundary, you get angry, you throw a tantrum if you're very small, but that's punished. So it takes time and it's a step-by-step process. So yes, definitely be very kind with yourself. That is such an important message because it's so true and so important. One step at a time. And it's never too late. That is one thing that it's so important. Like, I mean, we're in our 40s. And it's like, I do say that to my husband all the time. He's like, I'm beginning to leave now. Like, I am no contact 3.5 years. And my no contact was not predetermined, as in I set one boundary with my mother, which took a lot of courage for me to even do that at the time. And then she just never spoke to me again. And I'm like, okay. And it became a conscious choice. So now it is a conscious choice, even if she attempted, there'd be like an absolute no. But that capacity to have that space allowed for that healing, which was a step-by-step process. But the life now is just such a different thing. And I don't know, like, what has been your experience of that? But like, not having that constant toxicity bringing you back in those patterns all the time is such a freeing thing.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. So after I sort of like broke up, quote unquote, with my friend, that best friend that I was describing, that was in 2022. At the beginning of 2023, I read cards, and so I did a card reading and I asked, what is the theme of 2023 going to be for me? And this was an oracle deck, and I pulled the Freedom card. And I was like, huh, I don't know what that means. You know, I thought, oh, maybe I'll go on some like fun road trips. You know, like I didn't know what that meant. That was the year I went no contact with first my dad, then my sister, then my mom at the very end of the year. And when I look back on it, I went, oh, that's what it was. But I'll also say, you know, when you're so used to, oh, I get love if I do XYZ things, right? Like I'm the people pleaser, I'm the doormat, I'm the harmonizer in the family. It may not feel good at first, you know, it may not feel like freedom. It may just feel like loss because there was a way to get a feeling that you had love and belonging. There was a way. And so I didn't initially walk out of those relationships and like skip down the road. I was in grief for a very long time, and there's still an element of grief for me. And I also, as I have come out of those relationships and I have really turned my attention to the mothers in my life who are healthy, and I watch how they interact with their children, I really, it's like it opens up so much information to me and so many aha moments. You know, like yesterday when you and I were talking, we were talking about what are the things that healthy mothers can bring that narcissistic mothers can't. And getting like really getting familiar with those things, feeling into those things, witnessing those things, having those things be extended toward me in my healthier relationships now. It really reminds me, like, this is why I did this. This is why. Because these are the things I deserve.
I get that. Knowing your value and you also your values, it's so key within that process. And I was the in my family, I was the absolute center point. So my family, it's a big Italian family, not many siblings, but a heap of grandparents, and you know, like, and then they all divorced a couple of times. So we have crazy extended family. I was the go-to human being since I was about 3 years old that everyone got on with, and I made sure I just coordinated so that no one fought with one another. I minimized the damage of everyone. It was a full-time job. As you said, once I just started setting boundary, this was a little bit before going no contact with my mother because the boundaries had started with other members, but the withdrawal symptoms of that that I was not getting validation anymore. And that
Yeah.
is crazy. Like, you actually are like a drug addict going, oh my God, that's gone. And so, yes, you have to. That's, again, being so kind with yourself, because you are going to have those. I do say no contact is not the solution. First of all, it's not the only one solution. There are other
Sure.
ways, depending on the situation. It's such a personal choice. But also, there is not the final solution unless we do the work after that, because those dynamics, those patterns, your mother sitting on your shoulder is going to remain there. I live about, like, we have a continent. She's in Italy, I'm in Ireland. So there's like a lot of land and ocean between us. And still, those patterns were in my system, no matter what. So the work is important, no matter what. The dealing with that
Yeah.
grief, getting inspired by healthy mothers, second mother figures, which they don't have to be an actual second mother figure, but women that actually give you that support, that unconditional love, that make you feel seen and safe, like a mother should have done many years ago, learning from that. So there's a lot of components to this work
Yeah.
that are very important.
Yeah, 100%. And I love what you said about second mothers. Is that how you phrased it?
The
Yeah.
second mother figure, yeah.
Yes, I have several of those in my life now. And it is so wild to me to be in those relationships and note the differences. And again, like that's not me trying to like diss my mom or like, you know, criticize my mom. It's just about me learning about a new reality that's possible. It's like, oh, we can have conversations like this. Oh, I don't have to tiptoe around your rage. I don't have to tiptoe around you telling me that I hurt you when I was just trying to like do something normal. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is what it looks like. And that is so powerful because it really widens your horizon and your frame of reference where you start to go, oh, this is what I want now. Because for so long, I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know this was available. I didn't know these people were doing this, right? And so when I have access to that, then I can start applying that to other areas of my life, like friendships, romantic relationships, you know, work dynamics, etc.
Yeah. Brilliant. So Remy, we've been talking for about an hour. And that's been like an amazing conversation. So many beautiful insights. And thank you so much for sharing from your personal experience, because that's always precious for everyone to hear and feel less alone in this experience. So before we close, is there anything else that you would like to say or you would like to add that we feel maybe we've left out?
I feel like we covered so much. I just want to say, you know, if you are in this process of realizing that your mother might be a narcissist or that she is, right? Like one of those, and you are feeling that heartache of digesting the information that narcissists can't love the way that the rest of us love, just know that you're not alone and there are resources for you. There is love available to you. There is safety available. It's just about taking the reins, you know, making that choice. And it's not easy. I don't say that. There's a lot of weight to that. It takes fortitude. And I just want to say, like, you can do it. You can do it.
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. You are an infinitely powerful human being, all of you listeners, and of course, us included, everyone. So you can definitely do that, and you're not alone in this. I love that. That's a beautiful message. So we're going to close with that. So, yeah, thank you, Remy, for being with us. And thank you, everyone, for listening in. If you're wanting to connect more with Remy, all her links are going to be in the descriptions of this episode, so you can find her. And yeah, with that, I'm going to wish you a wonderful rest of your week and lots of love. Bye for now.